From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his new book, Perfectly Legal, New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston lays out how the super rich have tilted the U.S. tax system to line their pockets and, he says, cheat everyone else. Tonight on Point, a top reporter's outrage at what he calls the rigging of the American tax system and its ugly consequences for fairness and democracy. But first, we begin in Washington, where President Bush said today that he, too, wants to know the facts about pre-war intelligence failures regarding Iraq's weapons capabilities. But the president did not support calls for an independent investigation of how and why Washington followed flawed intelligence to war. Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her exactly what the president had to say today.
The question that he was asked was, now that your own arms inspector, David Kaye, has said there's a need for an independent inquiry, why don't you agree with that? And the president basically sidestepped that question. And what he said was that he wants to know more than anybody else what we knew before and what we've learned on the ground and compare them and draw lessons from it. But he is not saying, and specifically is avoiding the question of an independent inquiry.
What's happening with pressure for such an inquiry? At this point, David Kaye has asked for it. Plenty of Democrats, including Democratic presidential contenders, have asked for it. John McCain, Republican, has asked for it. Is it going anywhere?
It looks like it. There seems to be a groundswell of support for the idea from both ends of the political spectrum. Remember, many Republicans have had questions about the validity of a lot of the intelligence being sent to the White House. Their concerns are from a completely different point of view, that they think that threats have been underestimated for many, many years. But regardless, there's sort of a collusion of interest now between conservative Republicans and Democrats on this issue, and it's possible that it will pick up steam. It remains to be seen, though, whether this will become an important issue to the public and the voters.
What are the White House options here, Maura? In a campaign year, with all of this coming out and David Kaye's testimony being particularly difficult, how can they handle this?
Well, there aren't a lot of good options for them. And right now they seem to be taking a wait and see and hope it dies down tactic towards it. If they were actually to take action, it would actually probably cause a tremendous amount of turmoil. An independent investigation would probably drag on for ages. Look at what has happened with the 9/11 Commission. They're asking for an extension. It would keep the issue out in public for a very long time. And that is the last thing that Bush really wants, is an issue that goes to his credibility and to the credibility of his signature issue, national security and the war on terrorism, during his reelection year.
Well, what exactly is the investigation that critics are calling for here? Is it of the American intelligence apparatus and its failures around WMD in Iraq, or is it aimed more at the political side and how the White House and Defense Department civil leaders interpreted the intelligence they got?
Well, it sort of depends on who you are. Both things are being said. Democrats have long said, and you hear this from the nominees on the campaign trail as well, that the president deliberately misled the country, that the intelligence was distorted. And that suggests that the intelligence could have been good except for the political leadership. But what David Kaye is saying is something very different, and that is that the intelligence, that its analysis was flawed all along and has been flawed for a very long time, not just on Iraq, but on other countries, including Libya and Iran, and that it predates this administration, goes back to Clinton and maybe farther. And that's a different set of issues. And at some point, if there's going to be a commission, they're going to have to see eye to eye on this, get a set of questions, and coordinate it properly.
All of this would seem to come to bear on the president's strategy of preemptive war. If you can't have good, solid intelligence, it's difficult to make the case for preemptive war.
And that's exactly where the White House is refusing to go. In answer to any of these questions about the Kaye testimony, they repeat their talking points, which is that Saddam Hussein posed a grave and gathering threat to the United States, and they just will not look at the question, no matter how often they're asked, of how can you make a decision to go to war if you can't be certain that your intelligence is accurate?
We see that the former Secretary of Defense William Cohen is also asking for an inquiry today. So, and he's Republican. What are Republicans bringing to this, those who have joined the call for an investigation, including John McCain? What's their rationale?
Well, I think it's a very pragmatic one. I think that Republicans who are thinking seriously about foreign policy, and there's a lot of them, recognize that it's very hard to have good decisions if you don't have good intelligence. And this is why this issue, at least at the moment, seems to be picking up steam, is that moderate Republicans who are probably not in public right now criticizing the administration directly, but in private they've got serious qualms about this. Conservative Republicans who have had questions about the intelligence community for many years are in public asking about it. And, of course, Democrats are just going to town. So there's sort of a collusion of interests here.
But for the time being, the White House counting on many Americans agreeing that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. It's a good thing that he's gone, and we don't need to probe much more beyond that.
I think the White House has basically two tacks here. One is that if you look at exit polls out of Iowa and New Hampshire, many more voters said that their primary interest in casting their vote was the economy and health care and jobs. And Iraq was down on that list. So as long as voters and the public as a whole don't make this a front and center issue, then it will be easier for the White House to sort of hope that it dies down. The second thing that the White House has going for them is what's their sort of standard communication strategy. And you've seen them do this with previous issues, for instance, the corporate corruption scandals, where they just simply stick to their guns. And they believe that by articulating what they think the message is, what they think the issues are, in a very rigid and firm manner, and not crediting the criticism of the public or of congressional leaders, that they will be able to sort of make the issue go away.
Maura, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me earlier from Washington. Since 1995, New York Times reporter David K. Johnston has had the American tax system and the IRS as his beat. He's dug into how taxes are paid, who pays, and who doesn't. And what he's found, he writes in his new book, Perfectly Legal, is an outrage. The super rich, he says, have further enriched themselves and used the tax system to rope the rest of the country into subsidizing their lavish lifestyles. It's not even subtle, he says. It's gross and grossly unfair. As you sit down to prepare your taxes this season, what he has to say will rankle you. David K. Johnston says it should. Tonight on Point, a tax system called rigged and its consequences for American life and American democracy. Has your W-2 form arrived in the mail? Do you assume everyone in America pays more or less their fair share? Or do you buy that the American tax system has been hijacked to serve the richest of the rich? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times business reporter David K. Johnston. His new book is Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. Good evening and welcome, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. It's a hot title, and as I dipped into it, it's a hot book. And I have to say, having read your reporting for years, and you've brought a lot of eyebrow-raising stories out of the IRS, even with all that, I was struck by the tone of outrage that's not ordinary in contemporary American reporting here. You've spent a lot of years looking at the IRS and the American tax system, and come away, it reads, David K. Johnston, mad.
Well, I'm actually one of the more jovial people you've probably ever meet in life, but certainly most people who've read the book have come away from it pretty angry. On the other hand, there have been two different meetings I've been at now where both right-wing and left-wing people who understand the tax system have spoken, and they on both sides have said that I've threaded the needle and I've accurately described what's going on. And the problem is the American public doesn't know that because the news media has generally simply parroted the well-practiced lines of politicians about the tax system.
We want to dig in and really understand what you're saying here when you talk about the poor and the middle class and the upper middle class and even the kind of modest rich, almost everybody subsidizing the super rich. But you conclude, after all these years of reporting that you've pulled together in the book, you say the tax system is becoming a tool to turn the American dream of prosperity and reward for hard work into an impossible goal for tens of millions of Americans and into a nightmare for others. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have a system now in America in which many people who are in the middle class and the upper middle class pay a larger share of their income in taxes than people who are fabulously well off and have an income of millions, tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And let me give you one simple example of this. In 1983, Congress voted to raise Social Security taxes. Mm-hmm. So instead of being a pay-as-you-go system, it would be a pay-in-advance system. The promise was that that money would be used to pay off the federal deficit so that when the boomers were in full retirement, the government would have the capacity to borrow money mm-hmm. to pay benefits to the boomers. If you make $50,000, the government this year will take from you about $7,500, half from your paycheck and half matched by your employer. And that's really wages that you gave up. It's
right.
just done in a stealthy way. Mm-hmm. But the government only needs $5,000 to pay benefits this year. So what did the government do with the other $2,500 that they took from you? They went and spent it. They spent it on tax cuts for the super rich. In essence, they're funneling that money, $48 a week if you're making $50,000 a year, out of your pocket and into the pockets of people whose annual income is in the millions of dollars a year.
You say that the tax system is being used to create a nation with fewer stable jobs, less secure retirement income, and being used by the rich by your lights, to shift risks off themselves and on to everyone else. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have, for example, in this country, moved away from having traditional defined benefit pensions. That's, you know, you work, at the end of it, you get a percentage of your salary based on how many years you've worked for the rest of your life, which is generally financed with money on top of your salary, to a system of 401k savings plans, where you save money out of your salary instead of having money set aside on top of it. You assume the risks of investing that money. And then we allow a huge amount of this money to be invested with your own employer. And there have been numerous examples, and I cite some in Perfectly Legal, where the company goes bankrupt. The bosses at the company walk away with huge fortunes, often with 100% of their retirement plans. And the rank and file workers are wiped out. They have nothing for their retirement. That's simply, by any standard, I don't think, a fair system.
You say, David K. Johnston, that when a government sets tax rates and tax policy, it's making decisions about who will prosper and how much they'll prosper. So if that's the case, what's the picture? What's the decision the U.S. government is making today, and how does it compare with the frame that it's drawn around society in past years, past decades?
Well, that's where we get to the core issue here, that this is not a part of normal capitalism. We have shifted the burden of taxes, and increasingly will do so in the years ahead, off of those who have been the biggest economic beneficiaries of America onto those way down the income ladder. The result of this is that in 1993, if you were one of the 400 highest income people in America, you paid 30 cents on the dollar in federal income taxes. In the year 2000, and the people in that group that year had an average income of $174 million each. That's 1 year's income, $174 million each. You paid 22.2 cents in federal income taxes. So you had a huge tax cut, 30 cents on the dollar to 22.2. And by the way, during those years, your income nearly quadrupled in that group. They're not the same people, but the 400 in the group.
So income going up, the portion going to taxes going down, and David K. Johnston says it's not fair. Stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about what David K. Johnston calls an astonishingly skewed federal tax system, how it got that way, and how it's rigged, he says, for the rich. Has your W-2 form come in the mail? Does it offer you the kinds of loopholes that are there for the billionaire? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight is New York Times reporter and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston. His new book is Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. You can join this conversation. Do you assume that everyone in America pays more or less their fair share of taxes? Do you buy that the American tax system has been hijacked to serve the interests of the rich? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David K. Johnston, there's a lot of detail I want to hear, but I think we need to step back first and ask you this. This kind of argument that you're putting forward is not popular in American politics. The charge is right away class warfare. The presumption is often that whoever's making this charge is, raging red socialist income redistributor. Where do you start from here? What was your starting point in 1995 when you set out to look at the U.S. tax structure? Do you have a political axe to grind here? How did you come at it?
Yeah, I'm not an ideologue at all. I've spent most of my career, and I've been a reporter since 1966, looking at big, complex law enforcement issues in America and how efficiently and effectively the regulation of casinos works, the regulation of public utilities, the operations of the Los Angeles Police Department when I was at the Los Angeles Times. My interest was, I pay a lot of taxes. Like everybody else, I'm not happy about what I pay in taxes. But how exactly does this system operate? And from reading news accounts over the years and all the books that I read, and I'm a voracious reader, I didn't have a sense of, what actually happens after the laws are passed as opposed to what the politicians say when we're debating tax policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1995, I persuaded the New York Times that we should go and start examining this from lots of different perspectives and see what we would find. I had no idea what we were going to find, and I've reported what I did find.
So what is that gap, then, between the rhetoric and reality as you see it?
Well, politicians are the principal source, I think, of our information about the tax system.
It's too complicated for most people to get in there and figure it out themselves.
That's correct, and including a lot of politicians.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a whole group of people, campaign donors, organizations they support, who have developed over time a whole lot of practice lines for politicians to say that have gotten us away from debate. We hardly hold public hearings anymore in Congress before we vote on tax bills. They get passed in the dead of night. No one knows what's in them. There was a time when there were open meetings and discussions mm-hmm. about this.
Mm-hmm.
So fundamentally, we've gone to Madison Avenue techniques instead of serious debate about how the tax system operates. And as a result, we've gotten a system that is skewed in favor of those people who get to sit down with politicians and spend a lot of time explaining their concerns. That's not you or me. We get greeted in the shopping mall by somebody saying, "Hi, I'm Joe Blow. I'm running for office. I'd like your vote." We don't get to sit down and say, "I'd like to petition my government for these things."
And as a result, you say it ends up working for the rich. These are hot charges, and they're big charges, and they go to the sort of fundamental cohesion of the country. David K. Johnston, step up and put some meat on the bones of these charges. Persuade me, persuade our listeners, that it's as egregious as you suggest. What's going on that's so out of whack by your lights?
Okay. In the book, I named two billionaires who have a business in America who have admitted under oath they didn't file a tax return for 30 years. Nothing has happened to them. On the other hand, Maritza Reyes, a woman in East Los Angeles who cleans houses for a living and makes $7,000 a year, had the full weight of the United States government come down on her because of a half-digit change in her address. And but for a volunteer lawyer, a law school student actually, she'd be in debt for $7,000 to the government, which means for the rest of her life.
So are you saying that, for starters, that leave the details of the law aside, that the tax system, tracks low and moderate income Americans closely but doesn't pay attention to the fat cats? That wouldn't seem to make sense.
Well, it wouldn't make sense. But what we have in America are two tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners. The government knows what you make. It takes the money out of your check before you get it. It even knows how much you paid in mortgage interest. The other system is for very wealthy investors, landlords, and business owners. They control what the government knows about them. And we have radically cut back on audits, which is, remember now, the IRS are the tax police, and auditing is an investigative tool of the tax police.
Mm-hmm.
We've radically cut back on audits of this area. And surprise, surprise, if the police department in Boston were to decide to pull everybody who's on the robbery and burglary squads off of those and have them write parking tickets, what do you think will happen to robberies and burglaries?
So you're pointing first at enforcement, and you're saying the tax law is enforced more heavily on the poor, moderate-income Americans than on the rich. How big a deal is that, though? Are we just talking about some marginal loss of revenue, some marginal tilting of the board, or is it significant?
We're talking about a huge drop in revenue at the top end. We don't know how big it is because we don't have the data. But we do know things like there are several managers of hedge funds with multi-billion dollar offshore deferral accounts in which they haven't paid taxes, that when you read about a CEO who makes more than $100 million, typically they don't pay taxes on that money right away. They defer those taxes for 2, 3, 5, 10, 15, 30 years. And the company pays the taxes on their behalf. Well, that means that the executive, therefore, by delaying the tax, really pays less.
So they're operating under another system. That moves beyond enforcement to law and loopholes. So enforcement, right away, you say, tilts it. What about the tax law itself and loopholes there? You know, the way people are treated if they do follow the law or know how to wend their way through the law. What's the problem there?
Well, if you're a wage earner, there's virtually no loopholes available to you of any kind. You can chisel a little, but the auditing of those people by the IRS is a big trivial pursuit. On the other hand, if you're at the top end, you have all sorts of possibilities that you can do, particularly through partnerships and multi-layered partnerships, which are almost never audited, one in 400 of them. One of the stories I tell in the book is about an IRS agent who was shown a partnership tax return, and as he examined it, he realized that a $10 investment was going to cost the taxpayers $350 million in evaded taxes, and they would never catch it using their computers because they didn't ask the right question, and then they didn't lift the right data off the tax return. And the system is full of examples like this. But to get to your underlying question, Tom, let me give you an example of the effect this is having on incomes in America. In 1970, the top 0.01% of Americans, tiny slice of people, had about 1% of the income. They now have about 5% of the income. So in the year 2000, 27,000 Americans had roughly 5% of all the income in the country. Well, the bottom 96 million Americans had 5% of the income that year, but back in 1970, they had more than 10.
Now, you know, these are the kinds of numbers that we've heard a lot of in recent years. But
you haven't ever heard that number. I dug that one out, Tom, and that's a brand new. And it says the numbers you've been hearing before, by orders of magnitude, understated what's happening. 27,000 people to 96 million. The previous best-known numbers were 2.7 million. To about 100 million.
David K. Johnston, we grant you the numbers, and we acknowledge the work you've done reporting, digging them out. I only mean to say it's in trend line with what we've been hearing. But what we don't typically hear is this attributed to tax policy, to tax evasion, to lax tax enforcement. That seems to be the big new news that you're delivering.
Well, taxes are not the only area that are causing this, but let me point out that if government taxes you so heavily that you cannot save, and then in fact you're in debt, then you're not going to prosper. And lo and behold, the excess Social Security taxes that we've collected since 1983 total $1.7 trillion. How much is consumer debt in the United States? $1.7 trillion.
So these are deliberate decisions, you're saying, that are made by the government, and you're further saying made under the sway of wealthy citizens who can influence the way tax law is drawn up and the way it's enforced.
I'm not asserting that Congress set out to do this. What I'm saying is Congress doesn't see the effect of what they've done because no one's laid it out to them. And so they've passed all these laws trying to provide a benefit to the political donor class who are critical to them. And in the process, they have screwed up the tax system fairly well to the point now where I show in the book money is taken from people in the middle class and the upper middle class and funneled to those of the rich. Now, Congress explicitly, however, did this in the Bush tax cuts in 2001. In order to reduce the maximum tax rate in this country to 35%, and that only applies to the top 1% of Americans, Congress continued to have a system called the alternative minimum tax. Mm-hmm. That's only supposed to apply to that group, but hardly applies to them anymore. It now applies to the middle class. And under this, you can lose your exemption for yourself and your spouse and your children, your deduction for your state property tax, mm-hmm. your state income taxes and property taxes, and even the standard deduction. That tax will raise $500 billion over 10 years, and that money is explicitly and clearly being used to finance the lowered tax rate for the super rich. So here we have a congressman in both parties running on saying, we're for families in America. And in fact, they're not, but they don't understand that they're not by their policies.
But you say what it amounts to ultimately is subsidizing of people with an awful lot of money already. David K. Johnston is with us. He's a New York Times reporter. He's covered the IRS and American tax policy since 1995. His new book is Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. These are not mincing words. These are big charges. Listeners, what do you think? Do you buy it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tom is calling from Wakefield, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, I don't buy your demagogic guest's argument. There are a handful of super rich people who may be benefiting from some loopholes in the law. I don't dispute that. However, the vast majority of people, of upper income people, and I'm certainly not one of them, are paying disproportionate share of the income taxes. I have figures, unfortunately, I couldn't get the most recent figures in front of me, but as of 2000, the top 1% of taxpayers pay 37.4% of all income taxes, with just a little over 20% of the income. Now, granted, you're going to say, I know your caller is going to say, but that doesn't count Social Security taxes. That's absolutely true. But Social Security is a dedicated program to pay for old age pensions, and so that it should not be taken into the same account. And you know, and since 2000, by the way, the progressivity of the income tax has increased even more because the lowest levels of lowest level of income groups have disproportionately cut the level of the lowest level of the income tax rate.
Tom, we take your point, and let me have David K. Johnston pick it up. David K. Johnston, there it is. You know this argument. The Bush administration makes it often, and GOP says, look, the rich pay already a disproportionate share of American taxes. What's the complaint here?
Well, Tom's numbers are correct. The top 1% pays 20.8% of the income and paid 37.4% of the income taxes. When you count all federal taxes,
I want to get that again. You're saying they made 28% of the income
They made 21%. They paid a little more than 37% of the income taxes.
Okay,
but there are all sorts of other levies out there. There's Social Security, which we mentioned, and Medicare, and gasoline taxes and excise taxes. There's a whole host of taxes out there. And when you take all of those into account, that top group paid 25% of the federal taxes. They have 21% of the income. They paid 25% of the federal taxes.
All right.
When you look at this more broadly, as the Census Bureau did, the Census Bureau divided people into fifths. Now, those are big groups, but the top fifth, the three in the middle, and the bottom. The bottom fifth of Americans, who make about $10,000 each, paid 18 cents on the dollar in taxes of all kinds to all levels of government, and the top fifth paid 19 cents on the dollar. The other issue that is left out of Tom's point is that the percentage of each dollar, that is how many pennies on each dollar that the highest income Americans pay in taxes, has been falling and falling sharply. Well, for the middle class and the upper middle class, it has been rising. Now, how does one justify a system in which middle class families have fewer of their own dollars to spend, and in the future, because of the alternative minimum tax, that will get worse, and people at the top have had a sharp drop in how many cents out of each dollar they pay in taxes?
David, let me put that to our caller, Tom. Are you persuaded, caller Tom?
No, you haven't. The alternative minimum tax, which I agree, is a travesty. However, that was imposed precisely to attack the high-income taxpayers who were not paying their fair share, as your guest would say.
Right.
So it backfired on itself because it wasn't indexed for inflation. However, I also dispute the idea that if somebody gets a tax increase, a tax cut, that we're allowing people, when you allow people to keep more of what they earn, that somehow you've given away something. You're not giving away. That only applies if you accept the assumption that the government is entitled to everything that we own.
And but Tom,
if they give us a break, we're taking something away from somebody else. You're not. And
Tom, I don't make that argument, and I didn't make it now. Let me be clear about that. What I've said is that it's people in the middle class who've had their effective tax rate, how many cents out of each dollar they pay, raised So they have less ability to save, and people at the top have had theirs lowered. That's all. I'm talking about the relative action here. Rising taxes on the middle class.
And on oranges here, when you talk about Social Security taxes and gasoline taxes, those are, in effect, user pay taxes. If you're the Social Security system, which, by the way, is disproportionately favors lower income people, is a user funded system, basically. So I don't think it's fair to lump all of that together and say that we're not, you know, the people are not paying their fair share because Social Security taxes, it's a pension system, basically, and people who pay into the system get out of the system.
Tom, we've got it, and thanks for your call. David K. Johnston, what about Social Security? Is it fair to lump it in? And then turn to this bigger critique that Tom has made, and you address it in your book. Tom says, look, people shouldn't, they don't owe the government everything. If they get a break on their taxes, let's not moan about it. Let's be happy for them.
Well, in the first part, if Social Security were a pay-as-you-go system, then I wouldn't be writing about it in the book. It's the excess Social Security tax that isn't being used as promised to pay off the federal debt to benefit people on Social Security. It's being used to finance tax cuts for the super rich. That's what I object to and write about in the book. On the second issue, of course you earn what you have. I'm not suggesting that you owe all things to the government. I do want to point out, however, that if we don't have our democracy and we don't have this country and the ideas of our Constitution, we don't have all this wealth either. Political stability, the education of people, the building of the infrastructure and the maintenance of public health and things, all are the things that make it possible for people to have substantial wealth. And in all societies where you don't have an effective tax system, go to Afghanistan, Honduras, you don't have widespread wealth.
And you quote Oliver Wendell Holmes saying taxes are what
we pay for. The price we pay for civilization.
Or price we pay for civilized society. But then you go on to say our tax system now forces most Americans to subsidize the lifestyles of the very rich who enjoy the benefits of that democracy without paying their fair share of the price. Tom's saying give them a break. They pay enough already.
Well, I don't dispute that when I say in the book, wealthy Americans pay a lot of taxes. In absolute dollars, they pay huge taxes. But as a percentage of their income, they're paying a shrinking share. And clearly, people in the middle class and the upper middle class are being taxed at a higher rate than they used to be. And in particularly in the case of the alternative minimum tax and Social Security, the money is being funneled up the chain. And Congress hasn't addressed these issues. I mean, Tom points out, you know, the AMT is a travesty. Well, Congress hasn't fixed it. That's what I'm pointing out. You know, we need to go and address and fix these things. We're not. That's not the trend of where Congress is going.
David K. Johnston is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. His book is Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. You can join our conversation. Is this where the rich get their payoff for money politics? In a one-man, one-vote democracy, how has the U.S. tax system become so skewed toward the interests of the few? If David K. Johnston's got it right, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times reporter David K. Johnston. He's covered U.S. tax policy and the IRS since 1995. He's out with a new book. It's got an inflammatory title, and he says it deserves it. It's called Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Who's minding the store of American tax policy? Richard's calling from Peterborough, New Hampshire. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I would like to hear David K. Johnston's comment on the following hypothesis I have. I often hear the GOP and those who support the existing tax system argue that because the top fifth of income earners pay a, quote, disproportionately large number of absolute dollars into the tax system, that somehow this is unjust. And I think it ignores a central fact that all people in this nation and any country have certain fixed costs that they confront just to live. You have to buy food, you have to buy rent, you have to buy medical care. And this gets to the issue of progressivity. If it is true that the rich earn a disproportionate, a very large amount of total income, their fixed costs for living are easily covered, while the lower fifth struggle to pay those fixed costs, and in addition to that, the taxes they have to pay. So I think that the GOP type of argument regarding the total tax, the total dollars paid by the upper fifth, is really a red herring and ignores just the basic political economic fact of these difficult fixed costs that are difficult to pay for the lower fifth.
Richard, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. David K. Johnston.
Well, first of all, I'll make it eminently clear, the Democrats' hands are as dirty in this as the Republicans. But, you know, the idea of the writer, the caller is talking about the marginal utility of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
If you only make a very small income, one additional dollar can make the difference between whether you have bus fare to go to work or eat on the last day of the year. The more money you have, the less each additional dollar is significant. And that's the point the caller is getting to. The idea that taxes should be based in part on ability to pay is Adam Smith's idea. The father of capitalism in The Wealth of Nations talks about this. David Ricardo, other classic thinkers, all understood this as a fundamental principle. Those people who have gotten, in many cases through their own hard work, but in some cases through luck or through inheritance, a significant benefit from the society ought to be the ones who pay a significant share back into the society. When the income tax was adopted in 1913, it only applied to about the top 1 or 2% of the population, and it was explicitly sold to the public on the idea that it would only apply to what were then called surplus incomes. Mm. And back at that time, the moral tone of the country was that taxes from capital, income from capital, that is capital gains,
right,
dividends,
right,
rents, interest, should be taxed at a higher rate than income one earns by the sweat of one's brow.
Which would, of course, come down more heavily on the wealthy.
That's right. Would come down on capital rather than labor. Now we're in a society where the moral tone of recent years has been the opposite, that we should lightly tax capital. In fact, it is the stated intention of the current White House that we should have no capital gains taxes whatsoever, and that would, in fact, shift the burden of taxes off of people who already have assets onto people who are trying to save out of their income so that they can have assets. And as I've shown in other places, we've taxed away the savings ability of the middle class so that they aren't acquiring assets.
So here's where you say we may be developing a perpetual problem here that kind of driving society apart. Jim's calling from Boston. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think there's an important part of this debate that sort of gets left out, and it happens sort of at the peril of getting to the true point that David's trying to push here, which is, frankly, that the rich and the super rich sort of need to pay their fair share of the taxes based on the income they generate. But where that argument ends up losing steam is that it polarizes itself, the super rich against the middle class and lower income folks, and where you have the most politically active and especially active with their contributions is a swath of people in the middle who you might characterize as upper middle class or upper income people who don't qualify necessarily to be called super rich, but they vote, they contribute, and they find themselves victimized by the same changes in tax code that are advocated for the super rich. And I think that's an important part of the debate that needs to be factored in.
Well, it's an interesting thing you bring up, Jim, and thanks for calling. What about how do you see the breakdown here, David K. Johnston? Poor, middle class, upper middle class, rich, super rich. Where are you saying that the leverage, the fulcrum is here? Where does it tilt? Are the upper middle class also disadvantaged, or are they part of the gravy train?
The upper middle class are absolutely disadvantaged and being squeezed, and that's a major point I make in the book. Essentially, people who make up to $30,000 a year in this country, and half of all Americans file a tax return showing an income of less than $30,000 a year, half.
Mm.
They don't pay income taxes. If you're single and you're in that group, you do. But overall, as a group, they don't pay income taxes, and many of them get money back from the earned income tax credit for the working poor. If you are making as little as $30,000, you can have the alternative minimum tax apply to you, however. And if you're in the group that's from $50,000 of income, that's the top quarter of Americans, roughly, $50,000 of income to about $500,000 of income. That's the group Congress is squeezing. Now, I would argue that they generally are not campaign donors, and if they are, they're not in any significant way.
You'd say they're outweighed by the very rich.
Very, very much so. that large numbers of them don't vote. I mean, only half of all Americans voted in the last presidential election. And they're not, even if they vote, they're not particularly active in politics. And this is the group whose incomes are high enough and whose political activity is low enough that Congress is squeezing them in order to finance the big cuts at the very top. And we haven't even talked, by the way, about how by deficit spending at the top, we're further shifting the burden onto people down below.
Meaning that ultimately it will be paid by the folks down below?
Well, you know, when the government spends money it doesn't have, and right now we're spending $500 billion a year more than we're taking in, you can do one of three things. You can pay the tax in the future. You can cut government services to pay for that, or you can borrow even more money, which will further constrict what you're providing.
David,
there's no free lunch.
Yep, no free lunch. You come down with some very heavy conclusions here that this skewed tax system, as you see it, it constitutes a kind of real threat to fundamental principles that the United States was founded on. How do you draw that line?
Well, taxes are at the core of our democracy. We don't have our country if we don't have taxes. So I'm not arguing for more taxes, less taxes, but we have to have taxes to fund whatever functions we decide our government should have. And one of the first signs of the breakdown of a society is what happens to its tax system. You begin to see people stop paying because they view it as it's not helping. They begin thinking about not their country, but about my group, my tribe, my clan, my something, and the other. And there's a lot of evidence that that's going on in our society. You can certainly read it in the literature of some people who are rabidly anti-tax and who are wealthy. You can see it in the movement of people who believe that the United States government is a criminal organization, who are regularly out promoting this idea that taxes, that you're not required to pay taxes, that the government will imprison you if you speak up about this or don't pay them without any lawful cause. And they're not a little tiny group. You know, the Murrah Building bombing in Oklahoma City should have been a wake-up about how well-entrenched the idea that the U.S. government is a criminal organization, not, as I think it is, the greatest idea in the history of the world.
So bombs have gone off, but there are not that many bomb throwers. And yet you're saying democracy itself threatened by this because what? Because people won't feel part of the same effort at a certain point.
Well, if you take away from people who are striving to get ahead the ability to save, as I argue that we've done through a variety of tax moves, I think that you begin to erode people's faith in democracy. I mean, there is no place writ in stone that this country will endure forever. I hope that it does, but in order to do that, you have to have a government that is providing people with those policies that will allow them to pursue their lives, and if they play by the rules, to do well, and to have a system that allows people, for instance, to at retirement have their entire life savings wiped out while the bosses of the company that ran it into the ground walk away with multimillion-dollar fortunes is not breeding political stability.
David K. Johnston, it's a big and disturbing picture that you draw. The book's got a lot of detail we don't have time to get into tonight, but I recommend it to anybody. It's called Perfectly Legal, the Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. Agree or not, it is a very striking argument. David K. Johnston, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online, onpointradio.org. In a moment, the Bush re-election campaign goes on the offensive. This is On Point. With Democratic candidates for president in the political spotlight in the past several weeks at the start of the primary season, President Bush's reelection team has decided it's time to go on the offensive. Bush visited New Hampshire yesterday to tout economic recovery. Vice President Cheney spent the week mending fences in Europe. And today, Bush's campaign manager, Ken Mellman, attacked the Democratic candidates in a speech in Washington. Mellman struck at all four of the top Democrats, focusing particularly on frontrunner Senator John Kerry. Here is an excerpt from Mellman's speech.
We're not sure the name of our opponent for Election Day, but we already know the clear choice that the American people will face. That's because our opponents agree on an agenda that can best be summarized by one of the two frontrunners for the nomination, Governor Howard Dean. They want to take America backwards. As our economy finally recovers from recession, war, corporate scandal, and attack, every one of our opponents would take us backwards 20 years to the economic plan of Walter Mondale. They all want to raise your taxes. As we work to bring stability and democracy to Iraq, our opponents would deny our troops the support they need to finish the job. Howard Dean has said that America's military will not always be the world's strongest. And ladies and gentlemen, Senator Kerry's voting record would make Governor Dean's vision a reality. We salute Senator Kerry's honorable and heroic service in Vietnam, but we question his judgment in consistently voting to cut defense and intelligence funding critical to our national security. Even after the first World Trade Center bombing, Senator Kerry voted to gut intelligence spending by $1.5 billion for 5 years prior to 2001. In 1996, he voted to slash defense spending by $6.5 billion. Both bills were so reckless and so out there that neither had any co-sponsors willing to endorse his plans. When Senator Kerry first entered the Senate, he sought to cancel the very weapon systems that are critical to winning the war on terrorism and maintaining our military strength. He opposed President Reagan's effort to fight communism in our hemisphere and even opposed the first Gulf War. Some of our opponents believe that the commander-in-chief must receive a signed permission slip before committing troops to defend our national security. Ladies and gentlemen, by ignoring real threats abroad and weakening America's defenses, they take us backward to the dangerous illusion that terrorists are not plotting and outlaw regimes do not seek to harm us. Kerry, Dean, Edwards, and Clark also agree on the need to weaken the Patriot Act, which simply gives law enforcement the same tools it has to fight terrorists that it's already using to fight drug dealers and fight organized crime. Our opponents, including Senator Kerry and Edwards, who supported the No Child Left Behind Act, now oppose its high standards and oppose its accountability for parents and children. Our opponents unanimously oppose the bipartisan Medicare reform law. They oppose the ban on partial birth abortion, also passed with bipartisan support. That's not all that our opponents are united on. They're not just united in their plans to take America backwards to failed policies and false illusions. Without a positive agenda and without a vision for tomorrow, each of the Democrats has waged a negative campaign of vicious and unprecedented attacks on our president. They're not running for president to safeguard America's homeland or to bring peace throughout the world. They're not running for president to grow jobs or to improve the economy. They're not running for president to reform or improve education or to ensure health care for America's seniors. And they're not running to move America forward. The singular rationale for each of their candidacies is beat President Bush.
Ken Melman, President Bush's reelection campaign manager, speaking today in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.